This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
I'm here with Sean Blackman, a member of the core organizing team of the Stop Police Terror Project DC, and also a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Sean, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Eugene.
So the first question I wanted to ask you is, for those who don't know, what exactly is the Stop Police Terror Project DC?
Well, Stop Police Terror Project DC, we're an organization that tries to mobilize around issues of racist, militarized policing as it takes place here in Washington, D.C. Now, we were originally known as D.C. Ferguson, which first came about a year ago around the time of Michael Brown's death at the hands of Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. And that was actually first organized in kind of a spontaneous ad hoc way. It actually first came about as a result of a breakoff march that some folks did at a rally. And it really didn't even have a name. And the original organizers were telling people to just, you know, search the hashtag DC Ferguson. So that kind of became, you know, the name just as a result of its use over and over. And so what happened over time, we saw that the local police sort of begin to change their tactics, but not at all in the way that we would prefer. And I also want to make clear the reason, of course, why we were called D.C. Ferguson, because we want to make the connection that, you know, whether it was in Washington, D.C. or Ferguson, Missouri or Sanford, Florida or Oakland, California or Detroit or Chicago, these same racist police issues were prevalent. But what we're seeing now, because one of the main things we did as D.C. Ferguson was bring attention to a tactic by a Metropolitan Police called the jump out, where, you know, you're essentially walking around minding your business and, you know, an unmarked car pulls up and three or more officers jump out, not in uniform, but with weapons drawn, and they throw you on the ground. You know, they beat you up. You know, sometimes we even heard of some instances of them taking people's money. Excuse me. And this is all supposedly, you know, ostensibly, you know, looking for drugs and things like that. But the old police, they never write up the report of what happens or anything like that. They just kind of hop in their car and speed off. And it's kind of a real end run around your most basic rights. And, you know, we saw a very interesting response from Police Chief Kathy Lanier. You know, at first she outright denied the existence of the jump outs, even going so far as calling them fantasies, as she was quoted as saying once. But when she was under oath at an oversight hearing a little while ago, she kind of hemmed and hawed about it and, you know, admitted that, you know, maybe something like that, you know, happened sometime under certain circumstances and it was like a remnant of the war on drugs and things like that. But we're actually seeing an institutional change in the Metropolitan Police Department, in part because of the pressure we applied on them, because we went directly into these communities that are most affected and petitioned, and it really wasn't a question, which was something funny that I found doing the petition. Is like, well, you know, the people most affected by this are quite clear on what a jump out is, but here you are supposedly sworn to serve and protect them, and you act as though it's not even something that happens. So what the Metropolitan Police Department is doing now is they are changing the way they are organized. So the way it used to be was they were organized into seven different individual vice units, one for each district. So those seven individual vice units are now being consolidated into a narcotics special division and a crime interdiction unit. And the reason that Police Chief Kathy Lanier and Mayor Muriel Bowser are giving for this reorganization is to sort of change the focus from low-level dealers to suppliers of drugs, and also to accommodate a new focus on designer drugs, which they're saying is a new concern for them. You know, stuff like K2 and spice and things like that that they're saying are becoming more and more of an issue. But what we really feel is that it's actually an attempt to sort of make a cosmetic change to the police in Washington, D.C., and to not actually have to change anything they do, just simply change the means by which they exact this abuse on poor working and oppressed and black and brown communities here in Washington, D.C. So there's no indication that they're actually going to change their behavior. It's just going to look a little different.
And I want to jump ahead a little bit here and speak to some of what many of us know is that this current Black Lives Matter movement, or whatever it's called, really stands on the shoulders of many who have in the past fought for black liberation, many of whom are political prisoners. This month is August. And there's an observance called Black August. And I was hoping that you could explain for our... First and foremost, and then we'll get to another piece of it, if you could explain to our audience what exactly Black August is.
Well, Black August is a movement that emerged largely on the West Coast, I believe, to stand in solidarity with political prisoners. You know, there were people like Katari Golden and Hugo Pinnell, who were leaders in the Black Guerrilla family. And one of them, I forget which one, actually died as a result of medical neglect, and which is kind of interesting considering what's happening now with Mumia Abu-Jamal, having just been diagnosed with hepatitis C. And you know, some of these folks who were doing this work, of course, they were Muslim, and so the observances of Black August were actually fashioned after the ritual of Ramadan. So, you know, people who observe Black August, you know, we don't eat or drink anything from 6 in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. You don't listen to the radio or watch TV. And if there's some other personal sacrifice you want to make as a part of Black August, you know, you're definitely welcome to do that as well. And I think it's important that as we do the work in the Black Lives Matter movement, that we keep in mind these political prisoners and the observant of Black August, because they are quite literally the victims of state-sanctioned terror. Because a lot of them were railroaded into jail and prison as a result, essentially, of political persecution, not even necessarily because they did anything wrong. And it was to the point where you have people like, you know, Assata Shakur and Nahamna Abiodun, who are both exiled in Cuba. You see what I mean? And then you have people like Russell Maroon Schultz, who escaped from prison twice, which is how we got the nickname Maroon. And people like him who spend decades in solitary confinement with no human contact. You're allowed one shower a week. You have 1 hour outside a week. And they are in that condition as political prisoners because they are fighting for precisely the same thing that we are fighting for in this movement today, which is, you know, the ability for black people to be self-determined and to be able to have control over their social, political, and economic destiny.
And I appreciate you making that the connection there between the two movements and the importance of coming together. And so I wonder, as a final question here, what do you think a year on, when this show airs and those who are listening to this, we will be just about 2 days away from the anniversary of Michael Brown's death, August 9th. A year on, what do you think are some of the things the quote-unquote Black Lives Matter movement should be doing to continue to deepen the work, extend the work, and really uproot racism, which I think certainly has been the goal?
Absolutely. I think the number one thing that everyone involved in the Black Lives Matter should be doing, the kind of work we should be involved in, is essentially asking, how do we address the issues of militarized racist policing as it manifests wherever we are. Because, you know, the notion that these places where these things happen, wherever they are, whether it's Ferguson, Sanford, or whatever, the notion that they're not isolated, it still exists. You know, so now we're seeing incidents like in Texas with Sandra Bland, like in Alabama with Kendra Chapman, and all these other things, in Cincinnati with Sam DuBose. So there is no geographical limitation to this. Wherever you are, this is an issue. So the best way to do justice to this issue, the best way to memorialize Mike Brown and all others who are the victims of this terror, is to see to it that it cannot persist where we are, to absolutely shut it down and make this system completely unable to function and continue to abuse us in the way that it has. Now, that's sort of in the short term, but ultimately we know that since these attacks happen most often in poor and working communities of color, that ultimately the police have to be removed as an occupying armed force in that community. And we all know that really, we also know that really that can only happen if the system that undergirds the police as an occupying force is removed. And of course, that system is capitalism.
And quickly, you are based in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and this anniversary is coming up. Could you just tell folks if you have anything planned and what you have planned in Washington, D.C., in case they'd like to join?
Absolutely. Well, this Saturday, August the 8th, Stop Police Terror Project D.C. will be having a march and rally to commemorate the life of Mike Brown a year on. We will be meeting 7 o'clock at the African American Civil War Memorial. So come on out and support and do that. And at that demonstration, we'll also be announcing some other projects that we'll be working on as an organization moving forward.
Well, Sean, thank you. And once again, that was Sean Blackman, an organizer with the Stop Police Terror Project DC, as well as a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
We're here on Liberation Radio with Lily Daigle, the U.S. field organizer for Global Zero. Lily, thank you so much for joining us here on Liberation Radio.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
So first and foremost, for those who don't know, can you just tell us a little bit about Global Zero and what it is that you all do?
Yep. So Global Zero is the international movement to eliminate nuclear weapons, based here in D.C., but we have staff around the world, kind of pairing, I guess, really kind of cutting edge policy work with really kind of critical movement building from a grassroots level.
And so I think some people may know that we're coming up on the anniversary of the atomic bomb dropping in Japan. What number anniversary are we coming up on?
The 70th.
And so for those who don't know, can you just say a little bit more about the context, the devastation, those who were killed, just for people who may not be as up on the history?
Yeah, absolutely. So 70 years ago tomorrow, the United States dropped the first ever atomic bomb.
And that's
on
August 6th.
August 6th, yep. The first ever atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And this coming Sunday, August 9th, the U.S. dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. The atomic bombings of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki were some of the most devastating humanitarian tragedies I think the world has ever seen. Hundreds of thousands of people died in just a matter of seconds because of these weapons of mass destruction, and generations of Japanese and other folks, including Koreans, have faced some lingering effects from all of the radiation as well.
And that's Koreans in Korea.
Yes.
So could you explain a little bit how that happens?
So during the time of World War II, there were many, many Koreans working either by choice or not by choice in Japan, and just the nature of the where the bombs were dropped, there were many Koreans actually were killed in the bombings.
Well, thank you for that clarification. And so for those of us here in the United States, and many of our listeners, I'm sure, know that the United States, if I'm not mistaken, has the world's largest stockpile of nuclear weapons. And I'm curious, from your perspective as someone who does this work and talks to a lot of people around the country, do you feel as Americans we have a special responsibility from the point of view of the issue of denuclearization by virtue of where we happen to live.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the United States and Russia have 95% of the world's nuclear arsenals. So I do think that as Americans, it's kind of our duty as citizens to kind of speak out against this moral and humanitarian injustice and work to build as much grassroots power as we can in our communities to convince decision makers like President Obama that they need to take decisive steps towards reducing and eventually eliminating the global stockpile of nuclear weapons.
And I was wondering, and we'll get back to some of what you guys are doing here to mark the anniversary in Washington, D.C., which I think is interesting and exciting. But I wonder if you could just, what sort of things are you guys doing around the country to build awareness and to work on this issue?
Yep, absolutely. So Global Zero actually has this really awesome field program called Action Corps. So we have about 40 young leaders, or those that identify as young at heart, who have committed at least a year of service to us, working in their college campuses and in their communities across the country. So those Action Corps leaders are building local chapters, training folks how to do things, right? Like write letters to the editor or op-eds. They're lobbying elected officials. Many of them have already lobbied their members of Congress to support the Iran deal, and will be doing so again. They have been collecting hundreds and hundreds of handwritten postcards, and really kind of creating the grassroots product we need to convince decision makers that this is an issue that people care about and to put it back on the agenda.
And I want to slightly come back to that, but to shift to something you said at the end about something that people care about. One of the things that I personally have heard a lot about is that the nuclear weapons arsenal, beyond all the other issues, cost a lot of money, that it's very extensive. Could you just speak a little bit about that, sort of the dollar cost, and if you like, maybe the moral cost as well?
Yeah. Well, it's pretty wild. Most people don't know this, but the budget that Congress is deciding on right now actually allocates $1 trillion, with a T, to be spent overhauling the U.S. nuclear arsenal over the next 30 years. Which is an unprecedented amount of money. We could be using that money on healthcare, on college education, on housing, hunger, basically any and every other issue besides completely overhauling the U.S. nuclear arsenal. So, I think as Americans and as global citizens, it's critical that we let our elected officials know that we do not want our tax dollars spent overhauling an aging nuclear arsenal that doesn't even address modern day security threats. Like, we should be reinvesting our money in not only reducing our nuclear stockpile, but also investing in social infrastructure as well.
So from your perspective, and that's a very interesting point about the overhauling, I wasn't aware of that. I mean, what's driving this? Because if you're going to overhaul your nuclear weapons, the subtext to me there is that you are still actively planning to potentially use them. I mean, is it active nuclear war fighting, zeal in Congress, in the Pentagon? Is it inertia? What do you think is behind this, or the drive to spend all this money?
I think it might be geopolitics behind it, honestly. I mean, tensions between the U.S. and Russia are at an all-time low since the Cold War, and reinvesting in our nuclear arsenal is essentially reverting back to Cold War standards. On top of that, the U.S. does have an aging nuclear arsenal. It's pretty old, and if we want it to be up to date, we have to completely overhaul it. But we argue that we should not be investing in these weapons that don't address modern day security challenges, and rather we should be reinvesting this money again in non-proliferation and in social infrastructure.
And so to come back around to the point I was also raising earlier about the work you all do, for those of us who are students of movement history, I think oftentimes denuclearization, the anti-atom bomb movement, whatever you want to call it, was sort of a thing that existed kind of at two times, right? The 50s and the 80s, and outside of that, like, no one really cared. Now, I know that that may not be true, but from our current status, do you feel sort of a growing movement here around the issue of eliminating nuclear weapons?
Certainly. I think we're standing on some really big shoulders, which I feel very privileged. There's been a lot of great work done for the elimination of nuclear weapons, but we have a long way to go. People in their 20s or younger don't really think that much about nuclear weapons because we didn't grow up during the Cold War hiding underneath our school desks in these drills to keep us safe from nuclear bombs like our parents did. So a lot of people just don't think about it. But I do think with the work that Global Zero is doing with Action Corps, as well as the Iran deal, I'm having such an prolific non-proliferation victory under our belts right now will really kind of build the momentum that we need to kind of drum the movement, drum, I guess, and make things going again.
Absolutely. Well, the drum major instinct, as Dr. Martin Luther King would say. And so to speak to the Iran deal, too, I think that's interesting. So what is your, I mean, do you feel, because there's sort of two competing narratives right now, one that this is a deal that will help, you know, it'll further peace as opposed to war, and another that is coming mainly from the Republican Party that actually it means nothing and that it's just going to bring us further to the brink of death and destruction. Where do you fall in that debate?
Certainly pro-deal camp all the way, 100% behind the Iran deal. I think it is the biggest victory our movement has seen in at least a decade. And I think it's something that progressives and rational-minded folks all over the world need to voice their opinion on, to let their members of Congress or their representatives in whatever country they live in know that we need to make sure that this deal is enacted.
And so one of the things I wanted to make sure we got in here 100% is you all coming up on August 9th, which will be the Sunday after this show airs on Friday for those who are listening now. You have a very creative action planned here in Washington, D.C. I was wondering if you could explain what it is, and for those people who are listening in the D.C. area, tell them where to go and how they can get involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So on Sunday, August 9th at 10 a.m., we are having a very large event here in D.C. called Bike Around the Bomb to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We are getting hundreds of cyclists together to bike around the area of what a small nuclear blast would look like here in D.C. So we're starting and ending in front of the White House, and we'll be biking around about a 7-mile loop, which is roughly the size of destruction that the atomic bomb left when we bombed Nagasaki. So we'll be using that to kind of demonstrate public support and solidarity with the folks in Japan, and also kind of calling on our elected officials to take some bold steps towards zero.
And I'm not sure if you know, but if you do know, and there will be actions happening in Japan and other places to mark the 70th anniversary as well.
Yep. So at least for Global Zero, we're on Sunday, August 9th, we'll be having a global day of action. Most of the actions will be here in the U.S. I think we have 17 Bike Around the Bomb events happening in the U.S., as well as others in India, Pakistan, Berlin, and Cyprus. And then other organizations are, I'm sure, will be doing some very powerful events on Sunday, August 9th as well, especially in Japan.
All right, thank you for that information. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we close?
Yeah, I would just suggest if anyone's interested in joining us on Sunday, August 9th at 10 a.m., go to globalzero.org for all of the information.
And thank you so much once again. That was Lily Daigle, the U.S. field organizer for Global Zero, joining us here with Liberation Radio. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Excellent.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. Tune in next week for more from the struggle for justice.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artists. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets, at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events, and learn more about how you can get involved, pslweb.org. Again, that's pslweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.